Thank you. Well, good evening, comrades. I'll hopefully keep the introduction relatively brief. This is about a version of racism or a version of racial thinking that I think is largely obsolete. Although it was in its time quite a substantial part of British intellectual life. I'm not sure, however, how much it comes out in active politics, but you see it in writing in history, prehistory, anthropology, studies of British society, and you also find it in fiction, in works of creative literature. And I suppose the heyday of the form of racism I'll be talking about is from the middle or something after the middle of the 19th century until perhaps the middle of the 20th. And it may be that this is something that everybody knows about, but it seems to me that it's not very often discussed or identified as an intellectual tendency. And what I have in mind is a description of racial differences or identifying differences in racial terms within what the census would now call the white British population. So you've got a couple of examples on the handout. The map is based on a map that appeared in classic book of this tendency, The Races of Britain by John Beddoe, based on his own observations from travelling around Britain, where he could, measuring skulls, the cephalic index had been invented in the mid-19th century. First used, I think, to categorize prehistoric skulls. And prehistory is important in all of this. It's then applied by physical anthropology to describe the skulls of living people. The cephalic index is, roughly speaking, the width of the skull as a percentage of the length of it front to back. So you can be more round-headed if the width is large relative to the length, or you can be more long-headed. And this was used to categorise, for example, burials in long barrows of the British Neolithic were found to be predominantly dolichocephalic, long-skulled in terms of the cranial index. Whereas the next historical period, the round barrows of the Bronze Age, the burials there are much more brachycephalic with a wide head, leading to the aphorism of Thurnham, one of the co-authors of Crania Britannica: long barrows, long skulls; round barrows, round skulls, which was regarded as gospel in British prehistory for quite some time. It's now, I think, thought that environmental factors have quite a large part in determining skull shape, including the way the infant is cradled and things like that. So these are no longer regarded as quite such immutable genetic characteristics. But coming from prehistory, then the thought, we can look for differences of this kind among the modern population. We can trace who's descended from the long barrows, who's descended from the Paleolithic, who's descended from the Romans, who's descended from whoever. And Beddoe did measure skulls wherever he could. I think even doing it with calipers, there was a device called a craniometer, which was very uncomfortable, and people didn't like having it used. Even with calipers, it was a bit of a tiresome procedure. A trick that he invented to con people into letting him measure their skulls was to stand at a crossroads with his colleagues and pretend to get into an argument with them about the shapes of one another's skulls. And then, all right, well, we're going to settle this, get out the calipers and start measuring each other, hoping that passers-by would get involved and say, yeah, do me as well. Find out whether mine's bigger. So he did take cephalic indices, but he also observed hair colour and eye colour. He was the originator of the Index of Negressence, which is what this map is of, the relative frequency of dark as against light-coloured hair within a population. And he travelled around. It's scored, you can see, he gave 2 points for completely black hair, 1 point for dark hair, and subtracted a point for fair or red hair. And he claimed to have criteria. And you might think that the difference between blonde hair and brown hair is not in fact clear cut, that they shade into each other. He claimed to have criteria. And he went around, you can see on this, is based on more than 13,000 people who he'd observed travelling around Britain and written down their hair colour according to his scheme to work out regional indices of negressence. He says in the book, Races of Britain, that he didn't take account of people who seemed to be of the upper classes because they would be more mobile, so they wouldn't necessarily be descended from the ancient races. And in the Races of Britain, based on the relative brunetteness and a whole series of other factors, he identifies any number of races making up the British population and does his best to compare them to prehistoric skulls and skeletons that have been excavated and to identify which are the earliest, the most indigenous. And he talks about a Mongoliform race in part of Britain. He talks about an Africanoid race, as well as Iberians and any number of other categories, and tries to relate them to prehistory. You can see the general tendency on the map is fairer hair to the east, darker hair to the west. Bedder also comments sporadically when he's describing a particular physical type that the head is large but the intelligence is low, and takes the form of low cunning. That's in Ireland where he's describing. This is then used, or similar things. The source books for it are those really, Races of Britain and the Crania Britannica, which is a collection of descriptions and images of prehistoric skulls, collected and published by Davis and Thurnham. And it then comes to be it becomes part of the accepted currency, certainly of British prehistory, and up to a point of British intellectual life. And you've got an example. The example that you've got from Henry Jenner, I've chosen not because it's uniquely important, but because it covers a lot of ground in a relatively short space. And rather than scraping together quotes from here or there or everywhere, I've picked one particularly dramatic example. And obviously, Jenner has his own politics and his own preferences on ethnic and racial questions. Henry Jenner is of some importance in the modern revival of the Cornish language. The book that this comes from, A Handbook of the Cornish Language, was, in a sense, marks the beginning of the attempt in the 20th century to revive written and spoken Cornish, which had ceased to be in use. It's often said that the last native speaker of Cornish was Dolly Pentreath, who died in 1777. There's some dispute about whether she was actually the last. But it's clear that at the beginning of the 18th century, there were still speakers using Cornish as a day-to-day language. By the end of the 18th century, it had largely died out. So Jenner, who is Cornish himself, is interested in perhaps gathering together what can be known of the language and perhaps promoting a revival of it. Modern revived forms of Cornish are not exactly the form that you'll find in Jenner's book, because if you're reviving an extinct language, for Cornish, the earliest written evidence for Cornish, I think, is from the 9th century. So you've got a literature which is never very copious, but covers quite a long span of time. And the language changes over that time, and there are dialect variations as well. So you have a lot of choices to make in terms of spellings and grammatical forms. And whereas, you know, if you're learning a modern spoken language, you might think, well, the final authority is the people who speak it natively. But if you're reviving a language, then you can make your own mind up about which of the many possible spellings that occur in the manuscripts you're going to follow. And there are also words that would have existed in the language but happened not to have been written down in any text that survived. So you could borrow those in from English. You could think, well, if Cornish had lived, maybe it would have borrowed a lot from English. You could go to Breton, which is the closest living relative. And if there's a Breton word, unless it's obviously borrowed from French. Or you could look to Welsh, which is also related, but slightly more distantly. So the result of this is that different versions of revived Cornish have been presented in the 20th century, based partly on different theoretical or different approaches of principle to how you revive it, whether we're trying to go for medieval Cornish, or whether we're going for the very latest stage, or are we aiming for the Tudor version of the language? And partly based really on our subjective aesthetic preferences. Or, you know, do we want to make the spelling as phonetic as we can, or are we not bothered about that? And so on. So the result is that modern revived Cornish exists in various forms, none of which is exactly the form that Jenner presents. But I think he's uniformly recognised as being an important figure in the origins of the Cornish language revival. His political views, if you can't pick them up from the passage, he was, at the time he wrote this, a paid-up member of a Jacobite organisation, the Order of the White Rose, which claimed to want to restore the Stuart dynasty to the throne, and combined, I suppose, extreme romantic conservative royalism with elements of sympathy for Scottish and Irish national aspirations. So it's a kind of natural fit for the pro-Celtic, robustly right-wing Henry Jenner. And he's, in this passage, using the findings of physical anthropology and observations of racial differences within the British population to argue for Celtic and Cornish pride, that the Cornish are the real Aryans, the purest Aryans of the British Isles. What's meant by an Aryan here? The term Aryan originates from comparative linguistics, comparative and historical linguistics. And it was used in the 19th century as a synonym for what we would call Indo-European. They also sometimes said Indo-Germanic. This was the discovery that languages of India are related to languages of Europe. Not every language of India, not every language of Europe, but many of the languages spoken in India are related to many of the languages of Europe. In particular, the ancient literary languages, Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin, were identified as being related by Sir William Jones in 1786. And that suggests that they came from, these are dialects that have spread out and differentiated from a single original language, to which the name of Indo-European or of Aryan was given. Nowadays in linguistics, Indo-Aryan is used to mean the branch that is the Indo-European languages of India. So Urdu, Punjabi, etc. would be Indo-Aryan languages. But then, in accordance with these theories about skull forms and all the rest of it, the suggestion, well, if we have the original Indo-European the original Indo-European language, then maybe there was an original Indo-European race who spoke that language and conquered India and Greece and Italy and the British Isles, and subjugated the Aboriginal populations who would have been of other races and spoken other languages. And that's what Jenner is talking about here. He's saying that, sure, people in Britain now all speak Indo-European languages. They speak English, which is an Indo-European language of the Germanic branch, or they speak languages of the Celtic branch, like Welsh or Gaelic, all of which are Indo-European. But he's saying that doesn't mean they're really Indo-Europeans. Racially, you can tell from their skull form, you can tell from their hair colour, you can tell from other things. You can tell from the fact that they're Mongoliform and Africanoid, that these are the indigenous population of Britain. These are the natives who were subjugated and conquered. And so they're not really, the workers of the Midlands are not really Indo-European. They're not actually members of the white race at all. They only speak English because they were taught it by their conquerors. And so the slant that he puts on it with his Cornish patriotism is to say that the previous rulers, when they were driven west by the Saxons, the Britons who had been the ruling class before, or the ruling racial caste ruling over the Aborigines, rather than stay and be enslaved, were driven west. And that's why you find different racial characteristics, or allegedly you find different racial characteristics in the western part of the island of Great Britain, whereas the enslaved natives stayed there to be enslaved by Anglo-Saxons instead. When he talks about a Silurian or Iberian element in South Wales, it goes back to Tacitus, who had never visited Britain, but had been told that the people of South Wales, the Silures, had dark hair and swarthy complexion and looked like the Spanish. So maybe they are a colony from Iberia, from the Iberian Peninsula. And the idea that South Wales is Iberian is found uniformly in this. You can also then say that Ireland is Iberian. In the Book of the Conquests of Ireland, which is an early medieval work, the Milesians who conquer Ireland and replace the race of the gods, the Tuatha De Danann, are said to come from Spain. So you can say, oh, look, folk memory of Spanish, and Tacitus picked it up. They were Iberian, they were basically Basques or whatever you like. But in other cases, so those Iberian, they're pre-Indo-European, they're pre-Aryan, but they maybe are not the completely aboriginal Africanoid mongoliform workers of the Midlands. Ideas of this kind are very, very common. If you read a novelist, John Cooper Powis, makes enormous use of this. The novel of his, A Glastonbury Romance, I think the date of it is 1936. But in that, the different racial characteristics of Silurian South Wales or Viking Norfolk or Somerset being a bit betwixt and between, that becomes very important to the plot. In another of his novels, Porius, which is set in sub-Roman, it's kind of Arthurian story, many of the characters are Britons, but the tribal folk who live in the woods and have druids, they are not Britons. They are Iberians from North Africa, because he's absorbed it from this sort of material. So I'm not going to comment at all on whether any of this is other than historical fiction, because it isn't. But a few things that I would point out to you about how it works in the example from Jenna. One thing is that the example that he gives, that the lower classes of the Midlands have far less in common with any white man than they have with, we would now say, Khoisan peoples, the Inuit, the Sami, or indigenous Australians. Well, the Sami are Lapps, as he says, were very often taken to be the typical indigenous European before the Aryan arrived. There's a whole tradition that I've talked about in the days of audio talks. I mentioned it briefly, talking about why are goblins scared of iron, of identifying the fairies of legend as a memory of the pre-Iron Age, maybe Neolithic barrow-dwelling natives who would be Finnish or Sami. Nobody ever dwelt in the barrows, incidentally, and it's complete. They are burial mounds. But in any case, but with the exception of the Sami, those other examples that he picks are all from British settler colonies of the time. The Khoisan from the Cape colony, the Inuit from Canada, and the indigenous populations of Australia. And to a certain extent, what he's doing is treating Britain itself as though it's a settler colony like British settler colonies elsewhere. And when he's describing the Saxons fighting the Celts or whatever it might be, he's making that seem rather like the Boer War. That it's different groups of settlers fighting each other over who is going to rule the Aboriginal masses. And I don't think that comparison would have been lost on people in 1904. That just as that was a war between the British and the Afrikaners, he's saying that British history has been wars between different groups of white Aryans, where the bulk of the population are the Aborigines who are going to remain enslaved, whoever whoever takes over. And of course, what he's reading class differences explicitly in racial terms. That the upper and middle classes are Aryan, and workers are Aryan in Cornwall and the Highlands. But for most of Britain, the workers are a different race. The lower classes are racially different and he's quite explicit, racially inferior to the Aryan upper and middle classes. And it probably fits well with his conservative politics. It fits well with his Cornishism or Celticism as well. But the areas that he thinks are... the areas where he thinks the lower classes are white are, with the exception of South Wales, largely not industrial regions. Devon is fine. Workers in Devon who are probably mostly rural farm labourers. But in the industrialised Midlands, the workers are Paleolithic cavemen, as he writes. And you wonder slightly reading this whether he believed that he could always tell somebody from Devon and somebody from the Midlands apart by sight. I'm not sure that even John Beddoe, who'd gone around examining the racial characteristics of a lot of people, would have claimed that he could always tell with an individual. So it provides a certain amount of insight into what the word white means in racial or racist thinking. That it really isn't an observable matter of skin tone. When he announces that the workers of the Midlands have less in common with the Anglo-Saxon, the Celt, or any other white man than they have with the Khoisan or the Inuit. He's not thinking in terms of literally skin colour. And that probably is worth being aware of as a parallel with other forms of racism. It's probably also of note that if people ever say to you, oh, that, whatever it is, that can't be an example of racism because the people it's directed against do not constitute a race. I was just showing them this passage. Because it's very hard to argue that this is not racism when it has the explicit biological superiority of the white Aryan. And it really doesn't make any bones about it. But the group that it's directed against is one that I think nobody now would regard as racially distinct from Henry Jenner himself. So the existence of this kind of thinking is not in any way dependent on visible or observable differences. Racism is not about... racism is not caused by any real racial distinction, if such a thing if such a thing is thought to exist. And I think, actually, I'm going to stop there. There are probably other points that could be drawn out about the Henry Jenner passage, but I will leave them for the discussion. Thanks, everybody.